Today's scripture reading comes from Genesis 22. If you'd like to turn with me there, we're picking up in Abraham's life after an awful lot's been going on. And so we begin in verse 1 of chapter 22. Read the first 18 verses. After these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, "Abraham." And he said, "Here I am." And he said, "Take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you." So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him, and his son Isaac. And he cut the wood for the burnt offering, and arose and went to the place for which God had told him, of which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place from afar. Then Abraham said to his young men, "Stay here with the donkey. I and the boy will go over there and worship and come again to you." And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son, and he took in his hand the fire and the knife. So they went, both of them, together. And Isaac said to his father, "Abraham, my father." And he said, "Here I am, my son." And he said, "Behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering?" Abraham said, "God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering, my son." So they went, both of them together. When they came to the place of which God had told him, Abraham built an altar there and laid the wood in order and bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to slaughter his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, "Abraham, Abraham." And he said, "Here I am." And he said, "Do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, seeing you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him was a ram caught in the thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. So Abraham called the name of that place, "The Lord will provide." As it is said, "To this day, on the mount of the Lord it shall be provided." And the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, "By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you. I will surely multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven and as the sand that is on the seashore. And your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies. And in your offspring shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice." So far the reading of God's word.
Thank you, Wally. Good morning. Welcome to Midtown Community Church. My name is Gordon Fleming. I'm one of the pastors here. We're currently in the middle of a sermon series that we've titled The Gospel in Genesis. And what we've been doing is we've been looking at these stories that take place in the first part of Genesis to this point. And we've seen some stories that are terrible. We've seen some occurrences and some instances which are really, really bad, right? Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, the flood of the world in Genesis 6 through 9, the Tower of Babel in Genesis 11. But all along the way, as we've seen these stories, we've seen God has dropped hints. He's almost laid out a breadcrumb trail for us to follow. That one day, he's going to change everything. One day, he's going to come back specifically in the person of Jesus, and he's going to make every right, every wrong right. As Sally Lloyd-Jones said in her book, The Jesus Storybook Bible, every story whispers his name. And so what we've been doing is we've been looking at this book written 1,400 years before Jesus walked on this earth, and we're seeking to see where that's true. And we've seen how that's become more and more clear over the last few weeks as we've looked at the life of Abraham. Abraham first shows up in chapter 12, and his debut is spectacular. As Wally said, there's been a lot going on in the life of Abraham. In chapter 12, God shows up and he says, "All right, Abraham, I want you to leave home. I want you to leave your family. I want you to go to a land. I'm not going to tell you where specifically. I'm going to tell you later. And so I just want you to leave." But he says, "I'm going to bless you and I'm going to make your name great. And all the families of the earth will be blessed by you. Your descendants will outnumber the stars in the sky and the sand on the shore. And not only that, but my great Redeemer is going to come through your bloodline." And Abraham says, "That sounds amazing. But here's the problem. We don't have any kids. I'm 75 years old. My wife is in her 60s. Our time is past. You're going to need to do this in some other way. And God says, no, Abraham, no. Just wait. And so they wait. And they wait for 25 years. But then finally he comes, the promised son. Isaac is here, and they have unspeakable joy. His name literally means, in Hebrew, laughter. And they named him Laughter because Sarah said, God has given me laughter. And so then we come to this story this morning, the story of Abraham and Isaac, and it's an odd story. It's a painful story. It's agonizing. It's infuriating. It's masterfully told, and it's confusing. To me personally, it's gut-wrenching. And it has been for about 13 years, and that's because, well, I've been a dad for almost 13 years. I can remember years ago, I was a new dad where my 12-year-old was about 9 months old, and I was on a father-son golf trip in California, and we were sitting at breakfast in Palm Springs, California one morning, and my dad's best friend was telling us a story about when he and his wife were expecting their second child. And he said that back then she was in labor, and back then they didn't allow the husbands to come back into labor and delivery, and so they had a husband's waiting room. And so he's out there with all these dads and sitting there waiting, and the doctor walks out and he says, Pete, we've got a problem. Susan's fine, but the baby's heart rate is dropping. And I know you're a pastor, and so you may want to begin to pray. And so he did. He said he hit his knees right there, and he prayed, Lord, please save my little boy. Please save my son. And he said that as he was praying, he almost heard the voice of God. And it was as if God said to him, but Pete, what if I don't? What if I choose not to save him? Am I still good? Will you still love me, and will you still serve me, even if I don't save your son? And Pete said in that moment he had this crisis of belief, because he knew that intellectually he believed these things, but he finally got to the point where he had to ask, do I believe this at a heart level, even if God chooses not to save my son? And he said that he prayed right then and there, okay, God, you are good no matter what. Even if you don't save my son, I will love you and serve you with all of my heart. And he said just a few moments later, the doctor walked out and said, Pete, I'm so sorry. We couldn't save him. And he said at the time he felt a deep pain and an ache so significant that it was unlike anything he'd ever felt before. But he said in the midst of his pain that he prayed, you are still good. You are still good. When he finished telling the story, I was in tears sitting there in that restaurant. And he looked at me and he said, where are those tears coming from? And I said, Pete, I don't know that I could pray that. I don't know that I could say that God is still good if I lost my son. I don't know that I could pray the prayer that you just prayed or that you prayed. I think my faith is too weak. And so in a very real way, the passage that we read this morning is something that I've interacted with and I've struggled with for 13 years as a father. And it's one that I read about the time that passes between when God comes to Abraham and then when he finally shows up at the mountain. And I think of those 3 days and I think that would be my worst living hell. That would be my greatest nightmare that I could face as a dad. A test of obedience that's presented to Abraham that, quite frankly, I'm really afraid that I wouldn't pass. You know, I think God could come to me and he could say, Gordon, I want you to lose everything. I want you to lose everything financially. I want you to lose your house. I want you to lose your job. And I want you to lose all your money. And you're going to do this to show me that you love me. And I would think, well, that stinks. That would be hard. I don't want to do it. But God, I think I can do that for you. Or if he came to me and he said, I want you to do something for me that's going to show me that you love me. And in doing so, everybody's going to think you're crazy. You're going to lose all the respect anybody has for you. You're going to lose all your friends. Everybody's going to walk away from you. But if you do it, I'm going to know that you love me. And I think I could say, well, I love my friends. And I think I could do that, God. And I've been thinking through all these different things. What would I give up for God? And I do think there's things that I would and that I will. But this, the problem that Abraham is faced with this morning, it terrifies me. On some level, it scares me to death. And so this week, as I've been preparing for this passage and for this sermon this morning, I've agonized. It's been a super emotional week as I've prepared. And so I do want us to jump into this passage. Full disclosure, I brought this book up, the Jesus Storybook Bible, because one thing I've really enjoyed as we've been going through Genesis, she writes about a lot of the stories that take place in the story, in the book of Genesis up until this point. So I've enjoyed, as I'm doing sermon prep, going and reading Sally Lloyd-Jones' account of the stories that we're looking at. She's a great storyteller, and it actually really helps me to even understand what's going on in the passage. And so normally what I would do in a sermon is I would kind of recap what Wally just read. But instead this morning, I think I'm going to let Sally Lloyd-Jones do that for us and her story that she calls The Present. This is what she writes. God knew that a secret rescue plan could only work if Abraham trusted him completely. God had to make sure that Abraham would do whatever he asked. So a few years later, God asked Abraham to give him a present. Abraham liked giving presents to God. He gave God his animals. They were called sacrifices. They were ways to say, I love you, to God. But this time, God didn't want a lamb or a goat. God wanted Abraham to give him something much, much more. He wanted Abraham to give him his son, his only son, the son that he loved, Isaac. Put his boy on an altar and kill him as the sacrifice? How could God want him to do such a terrible thing? Abraham didn't understand, but he knew that God was his father who loved him. And so Abraham trusted him. Early the next morning, Abraham and Isaac set off. They climbed a steep, stony trail up the mountain. Isaac carried the wood on his back. His father carried the knife and the coals. Papa, Isaac said, we have everything except we forgot the lamb for the sacrifice. God will give us the lamb, son, Abraham said. They built an altar and laid the wood on top. Abraham asked his son to climb on top of the wood. Isaac didn't understand, but he knew his father loved him, and so he trusted him. He climbed up on the altar, and Abraham tied his boy to the wood. Isaac didn't struggle or try to run away. He just lay there quietly. He didn't make a sound. Everything was ready. Abraham took the knife. Tears were filling his eyes. Pain was filling his heart. His hand was shaking. He lifted the knife high into the air. Stop, God said. Don't hurt the boy. I want him to live and not die. I now know that you love me because you would have given me your only son. Abraham felt his heart leap with joy. He unbound Isaac and folded him in his arms. Great sobs shook the old man's whole body. Scalding tears filled his eyes. And for a long time, they stayed there like that in each other's arms, the boy and his dad. Suddenly, Abraham saw a ram caught in some brambles, the sacrifice. God had given them what they needed just in time. The ram would die so that Isaac didn't have to. So Abraham sacrificed the ram instead of his son. And as they sat there on the mountaintop watching the embers of fire die in the cool night air, the stars above them sparkling in the velvet sky, God helped Abraham and Isaac understand something. God wanted his people to live, not die. God wanted to rescue his people, not punish them. But they must trust him. I'll stop there. This morning as we look at our passage, we're going to look and notice three things that are taking place within the passage. It's in the outline in your bulletin, but I would even boil it down more. We're going to look at the call, we're going to look at the obedience, and we're going to look at the sacrifice and what's taking place within each one. So let's look at the first thing, the call that comes to Abraham, the nature of his call. God comes to Abraham and says, take your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the region of Moriah. Offer him there as a burnt sacrifice on a mountain. I will show you. A few weeks ago, we looked at when God showed up in chapter 12, and we see that there's three really similar things that are taking place within the initial call that came to Abraham and the call that we see today. First, we see that there's a call to go. He says, go, take your son. He says, leave your father's house in chapter 12. Take your son here in chapter 22. Secondly, not only does he call him to go, but he doesn't tell him where. In verse 12, he says, go to the land that I will show you. And today he says, go to the mountain that I will show you. And then finally in the call, God asks him to give up something huge, something significant, something monumental. In chapter 12, he says, I want you to leave your father's home. I want you to leave your country. I want you to give up your people, give up your safety, your status, and your culture. Give up your family for me. And this morning we see what he's called him to give up. Your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love. When God says to him, your only son, the son that you love, he's asking Abraham to give up something more than just his son. And I don't mean to say just his son. That sounds callous. But he's asking him to give up something more. You see, Isaac, for Abraham, is the only son that he has left around. Abraham has another son with another woman. That's another story for another day. But in chapter 21, he leaves the family. And so Isaac is the only kid that's left. And in a very real sense, he was Abraham's only social hope that he had. Here's what I mean. In ancient times, your social status largely depended on your family status. In our modern Western world, we live in this individualistic culture, and so we don't get that. You know, you are who you become, who you make yourself. But this culture was far more communal and familial. Much of your identity, your well-being, and the good of your family depended on your progeny. They didn't have life insurance, long-term care, 401ks, assisted living facilities, anything like that. And so their well-being had to do with their kids. And Abraham had been waiting on his for 25 years specifically. God said, this security is coming for you. And now he's finally here. The family line can continue all because of Isaac. And so when God asks Abraham to give up Isaac, he's asking him to give up all of this, to give up every source of finite hope and security. And so here's what we need to notice here. Something about the call that comes to Abraham and the call that comes to us. The only way that you're a Christian and if you're going to grow in your faith is if a call comes to you. In Romans 8:30, the Apostle Paul tells us, those that God has called, He's justified. If you're justified, you're made right. It's because God called you. In Ephesians 1:18, Paul prayed that the heart of the Ephesians would be enlightened in order that they would know, the hope to which He has called them. Paul is saying the thing that justifies you, the thing that makes you right before God, where you receive hope, is God's calling that He puts on your life. It's not how moral you are. It's not all the things that you do for God. It's not because you were born into a certain family or because you're from the South. He's saying that the only way you're a Christian is if you've heard the call of God. But He's also saying that this is how you grow as a Christian. The calling of God doesn't just come to our life once, but it actually comes over and over and over again. All right, what's the call? All right, that sounds super Christian-y. I was thinking about this last night when I was in college. I was dating a girl, and it was not serious. But one time, one afternoon, she called me, and this was before cell phones. So the payphone rang in the Sigma Nu house at Ole Miss, and somebody called me, and I went to the call, and she said, "Hey, I want to thank you because you have so raised the bar for the man that I'm going to marry one day. And so thank you for that. But," right, the but comes. She goes, "I just don't feel like God is calling me to date you." What do you say to that? You disagree with God's calling on their life? Anyway, it's this real Christian-y thing that we can use to get out of doing stuff we don't want to do, I guess. But what is the call biblically? Well, the author of Hebrews tells us this, and he actually uses Abraham as an example. This comes in Hebrews 11:10, where he says that Abraham was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose designer and builder is God. The nature of the call that we receive from God is to realize that if we don't have God, and we don't have His call, then we have no foundations whatsoever. I was thinking about this call to worship this morning. In the leader portion, the very first section, it says, "You are my Lord. Apart from you, I have no good thing." And that's what it means to hear the call of God, to remember that everything in our life pales in comparison to having the Lord. You know, every person has something or some things that are so important to us that they can become an object of our soul's faith. David Foster Wallace once said that we all worship something. We only get to choose what we worship. And all of us have something that if we lose it, our identity would be utterly shaken. Maybe it's your job, or maybe it's a relationship. Maybe it's a number in your bank account, or maybe it's like me 12 years ago in California where it was my child, my children. Or maybe it's like Abraham, your only child. But you realize that these things, though they're good at times, they're temporary. They're like sinking sand and they don't have any foundation. You realize if you don't have God, you don't have anything. And when you come to that realization, you're starting to realize the call of God. Abraham sought a city with foundations. He knew that that's where his security would come from, in God. Not in his hometown, not in his son. But how does it grow you? As you grow as a Christian, you realize that your heart functionally hasn't changed. That our hearts are idol factories. Your heart says, to be happy, you need this. To be important, you need to have this. But God says, no, all you need is me. And you begin to realize, as Jeremiah 17 tells us, that the heart is deceitful above all things. And so you return to the foundation. You return to the gospel. Growing in your faith doesn't mean that you're going to sin less necessarily, but it means you're going to repent and turn more. Martin Luther called this preaching the gospel to ourselves every day. Being honest that your heart is saying that you need to have something, but recognizing that all you need is Him. So to become a Christian, it means to realize that there are no foundations without God. But to grow as a Christian, it means to return to that reality over and over and over again. Even if the call is super confusing, as we see that Abraham's was. Notice that God called Abraham to go, but He didn't tell him where to go. He called him away from safety and security and only asked Abraham to trust Him. In a very real sense, the call that we see this morning, it feels like death. And you know what? Sometimes ours does too. But here's the thing that we need to realize. That sometimes the God who's trying to save you feels like a God who's trying to kill you. I know I've shared this a number of times, either up here or in conversation, but the times in my life when I've had the most significant spiritual growth, but the times that I've had my eyes on God the most or was closest to God was in times that felt like death in a lot of ways. And it may have been from losing my job as a pastor or losing my job in business or at a time when my marriage was in such a mess that I had two friends sit down with me and they confronted me on the reality of my marriage in a way that I'd never been confronted before. Or maybe it was when Kelly and I suffered a miscarriage just a few years ago. Looking back on these things, they were agonizing. They felt like death. But I see that that's what brought about the most significant spiritual growth in my life. And I know that you could say the same thing because many of you have told me the same thing. Brushes with death, job loss, significant pain, significant hurt, things that were agonizing, things that felt like a living hell at the time. But I know many of you have told me that to go over, you would do it all again because of the way that God used it in your life. Which brings us to the next point. This is the confusion of disobedience and what disobedience looks like. So Abraham is in agony. As I said, the thing that resonates with me in this passage the most. You know, the songwriter, Andrew Peterson, wrote a song about the agony that Abraham was in on this three-day journey. And it's called Holy is the Lord. And I put a portion of the lyrics in the front of your bulletin, but I think it accurately captures maybe what Abraham was thinking in the moment. Where he's saying, so take me to the mountain, I'll follow where you lead. There I'll lay the body of the boy you gave to me. And even though you take him, still I ever will obey. But maker of this mountain, please make another way. And so there's this agony taking place. There's this storm taking place in the heart of Abraham. But here's what we need to understand. This would actually be really, really confusing to him at the same time. A confusion that we can't really understand. You see, the traditional approach of this of the church in dealing with this passage is, we think, well, the message is, no matter how crazy this call is that God gives you, no matter how outlandish it is, we just need to obey, right? We think, well, the moral of this story is to just obey. God is God and you're not, so don't question Him, just do what He says. And I read it that way for a number of years. I thought Abraham was this model of obedience that we all needed to follow, but there's a problem with this. Because there's a problem if the emphasis is on Abraham's obedience. Because it looks like, at face value, that God is asking Abraham to disobey command number 6, right? Thou shalt not murder, which God would never do. So on the ethical level, it completely breaks down. But on the inspirational level, it doesn't really get at the cute confusion of his obedience because we don't really understand the context for Abraham and the context of the culture in which this book and this letter was written. The first thing we need to notice about this passage, and this is easy to miss, but God never actually asks Abraham to kill his son. Did you notice that? He actually asks Abraham to offer his son. He doesn't tell him to murder his son. Abraham, if he told him to murder his son, he could have gone in the other room and just stabbed him. But that's not what God was asking him to do. He was asking him to offer him up as a sacrifice to God. Now, because this is being asked of Abraham, this wouldn't really be shocking to Abraham. This wouldn't surprise him. God has repeatedly pointed out in the Old Testament, which Abraham completely understood, that the life of the firstborn actually belongs to God. The life of the firstborn was reserved by God as a means to cover the guilt incurred through sin. From a firstborn animal to the first fruits of the grains, it completely belonged to God. God says repeatedly, over and over again, that the life of the firstborn was to be relinquished. You see this clearly in the Old Testament story of the Passover. Do you remember that? But then even after the Passover, God says the life of the firstborn is still mine. Listen to what He says in Numbers 3:13. This is God speaking. He says, "For all the firstborn are mine. On the day that I struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, I consecrated for my own all the firstborn in Israel, both man and beast. They shall all be mine, for I am the Lord." So as agonized as Abraham would have felt in this moment, he would have understood it. because they understood it as a culture, even when we did not. Abraham knew that the life of the firstborn is set aside for the debt of sin that every family owes to God. And even though it makes no sense to us, it would have made complete sense to Abraham. If God would have said to Abraham, "Hey, I want you to sacrifice your wife Sarah to me," he would have been confused because that doesn't make any sense. God never would have asked that, but if he did, Abraham would not have done it. When God asked Abraham to offer up his firstborn in agony, Abraham understood it. When Abraham heard this painful call, he knew that God was calling his debt of sin to be paid. And even though Abraham knew all of this, it tore him apart and caused him infinite pain and agony. So this is where the confusion lies. Because on some level it makes sense, but on some level it doesn't. Listen to what the author of Hebrews said again. This is Hebrews 11, verse 17 and 18. "By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was in the act of the offering up his only son, of whom it was said, 'Through Isaac your offspring shall be named.'" Do you see the dynamic there? That Abraham is offering his son, but the son is the promised son through all the descendants who are going to come. The command of God apparently contradicts the promise of God. God is just. There's a debt of sin that needs to be paid. But there's a promise that God is going to save the world through Isaac. So in the midst of Abraham's agony, there would be great confusion on how the God of the command is also the God of the promise. How can a God of holiness be a God of grace? How can a God who can rightly call this debt of sin also be the God that promises that through Isaac all of the descendants and all of the world are going to be blessed? How could this happen? Think about it. Think about it for us here and now. How can a holy God, a God of justice, be a God of grace? If God is not just, how can there be hope in this world? What are we going to do with all the evil? But if God is just, then how is there hope for us, those of us who, if we are honest, are really, really sinful? How can the God of how can the God of holiness be a God of grace and of promise? And this brings us to our last point, and this is where it happens, in the glory of the sacrifice, in this glorious sacrifice. All commentators agree that the climax of the story is when the narrator slows down, when he slams on the brakes in Genesis 22, 6 through 11. The story had been flying up until this point, right? 3 days happens in 5 verses. And then the dialogue takes place between Abraham and Isaac in verses 7 through 8, and it seems as if it's almost happening in slow motion. Isaac says, "Father, Papa, we have the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb?" Notice Abraham's answer. Notice what he says to him. It's what pushed Abraham up the mountain. He wasn't going up the mountain saying, "I must do this, I must obey, I will do this, I'm strong enough, I can make this happen." This is not what's driving him. It's not his obedience that's sending him up the mountain. His answer to his son is, "My son, my boy, God will do it. God will provide. God will see to it." The Hebrew word "provide" is literally, "he will see for himself." Abraham is saying, "My son, you can't see the lamb. I can't see the lamb, but God will see the lamb." He's saying, "I don't know how God is going to be a holy God and a gracious God. I don't know how God is going to call this debt owed, but my son is going to bring about the saving of the world through his bloodline." But this is what's getting him up the mountain. He's saying, "God will see to it. God somehow is going to make it happen. I'm not sure how, but he's going to provide." Notice what the mountain is named in verse 14. It's not on the mountain of the Lord it will be obeyed. The mountain is named, "On the mountain of the Lord it shall be provided." It's not on the mountain "I will do it," but it's on the mountain "God will do it." He doesn't know how, but he knows that God will find a way to be a God of justice and to also bless the world. Now, this is where we have an advantage over Abraham. Because we can see what he would only be able to intuit at the time. We know that Abraham's little lamb, Isaac, could not bring the forgiveness of sin in the world. Neither could the ram caught in the brambles. Hebrews 10:4 says that it's impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. And so why did Abraham have to offer up Isaac for sacrifice? In 2 Chronicles 3:1, we're told, "Then Solomon began to build the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah." Did you hear that? On Mount Moriah. On the very mountains that Abraham journeyed to offer his son to God, the son that he loved, it would later become Jerusalem. Mount Moriah would eventually become Mount Calvary. Centuries later, a loving father with a breaking heart would lead his son up the very same mountain. Just like Isaac, he would carry wood on his back and be laid upon it. As Sally Lloyd-Jones ends her story, she says, "Many years later, another son would climb another hill carrying wood on his back. Like Isaac, he would trust his father and do what his father asked. He wouldn't struggle or run away. Who was he? God's son, his only son, the son who he loved, the Lamb of God." We have this story so that we can have some understanding of what the father did with the son. If Abraham would have been at the foot of Calvary, it would have all made sense to him. If Abraham was watching Jesus Christ on the cross, he would quote God's words to him in verse 20 or verse 12 of our passage back to God. The very thing that God said to him, Abraham would say back to God. He would turn it around. He would look up at God the Father and he would say, "Now I know that you love me because you did not withhold your son, your only son, whom you love, from me." Jesus is the better and more true Isaac who is not just offered up by his Father on the Mount, but was truly sacrificed for us. And now we too can look at God and we can say, "Now I know. Now I know that you love me because you did not withhold your son, your only son, who you love, from me." That's a big reason why we come to this table every week. This is an opportunity to come as a church and to remember the sacrifice that on that mountain that God the Father did not pull back the blade, but he pierced it into the heart of his son. Isaiah 53 tells us that he was pierced for our transgressions, for your transgressions, for my transgressions. And it was in his death that we find life with the Heavenly Father. Well, who's this table for? Who's this meal for? It's for anyone who's heard the call of God. It's for anyone who imperfectly looks at all the things the world promises us and says, "You know what? Those aren't my foundations. The foundation is that Jesus Christ carried wood up a hill, was laid upon it, was crucified, and died. But 3 days later, he was resurrected again." If you look to Jesus and Jesus alone for your salvation, then come and be nourished by this meal, by this food. If that's not you, if you hear the story I just told and you say, "You know what? That's a fairy tale. That's Aesop's fables. All this is just a model of how we're supposed to live," then I would tell you, you're reading it wrong. If you think you can earn or fight or claw your way to heaven, or if you just think all this is hogwash, don't come to this table. Instead, keep your seat, pray. But ask questions. I would invite you, go home, read the Gospel of John, and just ask God to reveal Himself to you. But I would also tell you to come back, come here. This is a safe place to ask questions. So we're told that on the night that He was betrayed, that Jesus took the bread, and He broke it, and He blessed it, and He gave it to His disciples, and He said, "This is my body that is going to be broken for you. Remember this. Take and eat in memory of me." In the same way, we're told that after supper, he took the cup and he said, "This is my blood that's been poured out for the forgiveness of sin. Take and drink, all of you." It's our practice here at Midtown, if you've never taken communion with us, to come down front and to receive the elements, to go back to your seat, and after a brief time of reflection and prayer, we'll take the meal together. I'll have a gluten-free option in my line, and so if those of you that are serving communion, if you would come down, I'm going to pray for us, and then we'll take this meal and we'll remember what Jesus did for us on the cross. Let me pray. Father, thank you for all the work you've done to save us. Thank you that our works are done in vain and they're empty if we're not doing it because we have and we recognize the glorious call that you've given us. Thank you that oftentimes you give us things that are confusing, but in the midst of our confusion, you tell us, "But I'm never leaving." Thank you that you've given us things to be reminders that you haven't left us, like this meal. And so, Father, I pray for those who know you and are loved by you, that they would come and they would be nourished and they would be fed on your body and blood. In your name I pray.